Okay, talking about neoliberalism as a theory of knowledge and its implications as universities are increasingly put under neoliberal governments. And essentially what I'm talking about is the problems of critical thought in English universities in the light of dramatically altered sociological conditions of conducting it. And that's following the reforms to higher education, which do in the English context represent its privatisation, certainly for the humanities and social sciences, in the way in which David Willetts represents it. There is no direct funding of undergraduate courses in higher education, and therefore it's privately funded with the students supported through a publicly backed loan system. So the implication of that, together with the forms of audit by which our research is regulated, for example, the which is the impact agenda, which Mike Power referred to in the last session. And what I'm going to be talking about is partly to do with the way in which higher education has become the deliberate object of public policy of a neoliberal kind, and in part it's about the consequences of adaptation to it by university managements and academics themselves. And I think a lot of people, in terms of Gaminda's representation of the ostrich-like behaviour of academics, I think a lot of academics thought that initially what was going to happen with the politics of austerity was cuts to university funding. That was what was feared. And when, in fact, the reforms brought more income into the university system, then academics accepted funding and thought the issue, or what was happening, was primarily issue of funding and not a profound transformation of the very institution in which they worked. And I think we're now discovering that the form of the funding matters and the transformation is extensive. And the profound nature of recent changes, again, as Gaminda argued, is not undermined by our ability to trace a lineage of neoliberal reforms back to 1985 and the Jarrett Report. Something highly intensive has happened in the last 3 or 4 years. So what sort of follows, I want to say, you know, set out two things. One is that neoliberalism should be approached both as an approach to public policy and as a theory of knowledge production, such that the commodification and marketization of knowledge is integral to it, and the forms in which that commodification and marketization are represented are highly significant for disrupting universities themselves. So first say something about neoliberalism as a theory of knowledge. From the perspective of neoliberal ideas of knowledge, or indeed neoliberal ideas of anything, their key perceived problem is that of monopoly, where monopoly is understood as a collective appropriation of power. So in this representation, the state is a form of monopoly, and neoliberalism operates within a state market dichotomy, and what it seeks to do is increase the amount of activities that are determined through markets, thereby breaking up monopolies, and in terms of breaking up monopolies, what are seen as the producer interests embedded and embodied within those monopolies. And in the case of higher education as a monopolistic system, because that's how they represent system of public higher education, that means academics themselves as producers. And from a neoliberal perspective, monopoly doesn't arise as a consequence of market failure. That is, that there aren't some goods that are properly, or at least in contemporary neoliberal, there's not some goods that are properly considered outside the market because of their intrinsic characteristics. In a sense, monopoly arises as a failure to institute competition, not as a consequence of some of the characteristics of the object or practices or services themselves. And so from their perspective, the problem of higher education is the failure to establish a market in it, or that's the hitherto problem, and now that's what is being done. And the market is itself a theory of knowledge. That is, that every individual participant in the market is knowledgeable about their own interests and preferences, and market processes aggregate those interests and preferences. And monopolistic forms are, in a sense, a determination of the preferences of others by a producer interest, namely us. And so markets then facilitate knowledge production and stop knowledge production being constrained within particular kinds of monopoly forms. And also there is an interest in particular kinds of social scientific knowledge, because if the issue is how do we produce markets when there are all kinds of other tendencies that act as obstacles to the full realization of markets, then the purpose of social scientific knowledge from a neoliberal perspective is how do we produce market-aligned behaviors. But I think there's also, you know, an additional thing that wish to mention, and it's one that, in a sense, a number of academics are complicit with. There was a meeting at the Houses of Parliament, because the Houses of Parliament now set up a social science division providing knowledge-based evidence for policy, is the argument. Previously there was a scientific unit, and now there is a social scientific section of it. And when that was launched, a lot of people spoke about the importance of expert knowledge to take politics out of policymaking. So that became a theme that a lot of academics present at the meeting and professional associations included thought it was important to advance the interests of expertise in that way. But from the perspective of neoliberalism, there's a more profound way of taking politics out of policy, and that's by reducing policy to the market. In effect, the market is a much more effective mechanism than the supposed neutrality of professional knowledge. And so marketization, I think, is crucial. And that means that the argument is to diversify the sources of knowledge, including the displacement of universities and their replacement by think tanks and commercial organizations. And as long with that, the subordination and displacement of the critical functions of university-based knowledge. So we have alternative knowledge producers alongside universities, and then also the constraining of knowledge produced within the university. One sees this incredibly strongly in the What Works centres, funded by an independent agency, one of the research councils, UK, funded because the government wishes it to be funded. That is not, you know, that is apparently not a breach of the Haldane principle, because it's still under peer review, which is the fig leaf of how national bodies declare themselves to be unpressured by government. But clearly, the ESRC was pressured to fund the What Works Centre. And What Works, if one looks at the descriptions of the What Works Centres or their terms and references, is that it's what works, given that some of you might think, this is a loose paraphrase, by the way, not the exact quotes from the terms of reference, what works, given that some of you think that changing social structures and doing something about inequality might work, and we're not going to do anything about that. What Works Centres. That's their full title. So it's emphasis is on interventions and outcomes that can be achieved given the level of inequality, given the preference for markets. And this is producing a re-engineering of the social sciences towards a form of behavioural science, or even data sciences, because big data is part of it, that eschews social structural determinants of behaviour except as external contextual factors and looks at processes of behavioural change. So the problem of access of people from disadvantaged background, you know, social mobility from people from disadvantaged backgrounds, is how do we increase or change the aspirations of poor people, not how do we abolish poor people, i.e. by abolishing poverty. So that aspect of the pressure towards behavioural change. But this is also occurring in the context of the privatisation of the agencies producing that knowledge, and that includes the commercialisation and part privatisation of the activities of social scientists themselves. So if I give a very quick example, people will have heard of Dr. Foster. So Dr. Foster is a typical research formation now that is being advocated by neoliberal policies. Dr. Foster produces the data on above average mortality rates of hospitals by which hospitals are evaluated. Dr. Foster is a private organization, part owned by the academics that founded it, so academics are brought in to the commercial utilization of their research, part funded by venture capital and part funded by direct government funds. And among the ways in which Dr. Foster makes money is by selling its consultancy on how to do well in Dr. Foster evaluation of mortality rates. Now that is circulating all the way through application. So if you think, well, the impact agenda is about a direct economic benefit and commercialization, but we fought for and won the wider public things, some of us did fight for and win the wider public definition of impact, but the economic benefits of impact include the commercialization of the activities of social scientists themselves and brings a commercial company directly into the university in that way. So Dr. Foster is now typical of things, and if you read yet, if you're in a position of receipt, I should mention, not mention the name of the research council, but were you to read a research council's funding applications for the impact agenda statement of anything in the area of big data, behavioural science, you will see that the impact agenda says there'll be massive public value of what we are doing, and this public value will be indicated by the commercialisation of research and the private company that we are setting up. That's a successful impact, pathways to impact statement, because research councils require you to have impact, have a preference for commercial impact, and although it's publicly funded, there's no requirement for there to be a return to the public for the commercialised research that they produce. So these all have consequences, I think, for the impact agenda as it's applied both in the REF and RCUK. And I think one of the ways I would characterise this is a characterization taken from Gibbons and Novotny. It's a long-standing position within the sociology of science and technology studies. Mode one knowledge is old-fashioned academic knowledge, perhaps as produced under the corporate university. Mode two knowledge increasingly was brought in to challenge some of the assumptions of mode one knowledge. From the perspective of Gibbons and Novotny, it was positive, the shift from mode one to mode two knowledge, but what was positive was the mix of mode one and mode two knowledges. In effect, the impact agenda means that no research is funded other than hope that it meets the requirements of Mode 2 knowledge. So if you look at pathways for impact set out by RCUK and the ESRC's interpretation of it, the recommended form, and Mike Power referred to this as well, is not simply to think of the outputs having consequences, but to bring the beneficiary user into the co-design of the research from the start in order to maximise output. Now, one of the problems with the designation of Mode 1, Mode 2 knowledge is it also fits with the language of interdisciplinarity and disciplinarity. And a lot of those of us who are interested in interdisciplinarity, and particularly who have used Foucault and so on, think of interdisciplinarity as critical knowledge. But I'll suggest to you that interdisciplinarity is a form of engagement across Mode 1 knowledge with a particular kind of audience in mind. And I would say the audience that's typically in mind is social movement based, whether that's linking to feminism, black rights, or so on. Interdisciplinary knowledge in that context. But what we're getting in the impact agenda is instrumentalized interdisciplinarity, which is market-based and directly different from that. So one of the ways in which we don't notice what's going on is because all the time everybody's telling us about the importance of interdisciplinarity. But the interdisciplinarity they mean is quite different from the interdisciplinarity that informs critical studies. And the impacts agenda is designed to reduce the time from idea to income. Again, notwithstanding what Mike said about, well, that was its intention, but it's got widened. Let me tell you about how the widening is a form of narrowing. Most studies of innovation suggest that such policies fail even in their own terms. One of the interesting questions to ask yourself is, why do the authors of the studies who say it fails in their own terms not speak truth to power, i.e. not speak truth to the funder of the research that says that the innovation policy of the funder is flawed? ESRC is conducting a consultation. Interestingly, with what Wendy said, a consultation with stakeholders is not addressing the evidence of the research it itself funds. And so consultation is one of the modes of interdisciplinarity. And the study by Tinkler Dunleavy et al. Speaks of the shift, and speak in positive terms because of this way in which we think about interdisciplinarity, that we've moved from research with to research about. Well, of course, in the context of critical interdisciplinarity, we all think research with is a good idea, and we think research about is a bad idea. But in the context of instrumental interdisciplinarity, we need to ask who we're being asked to research with. And we're being asked to do research with policymakers and business. I actually think we need research about them, not with them. And that's part of the problem. One needs to use about and with in a more critical way. But one of the things is the transformation of the field of people with whom we can research. That is, that if you say, well, and because again Mike said, well, most of us, we think there should be relevance and use for our research. And, well, I kind of like to think it would be nice to do research which contributed to a social justice agenda. Who is there to work with? Government and policymakers don't have a social justice agenda. We're just saying they have an inequality maintenance agenda. So an early phase of argument about co-delivery of services, etc., sought to link charities with local and national governments. But the latest phase of development is not the co-delivery of services between government, local government, and charities, but between charities and for-profit associations. So now we have a peculiar hybrid in the civil sphere, and that's a charitable front to a for-profit activity. And this is happening right across. Yeah. And the chair of the Charities Committee, outgoing chair Susie Leather, in 2012 spoke of the delegitimation of charitable activity in that way. And currently, an unpublished report, but research being undertaken by the National Coalition of Independent Action, this is an umbrella group of social justice issues, this is what they say, that actually neoliberalism has transformed the charitable sector, has transformed those working on social justice. I'll let you look at that. So, in other words, what is happening when the impact agenda is widened and could include social justice issues, actually the numbers of people with whom you could co-produce is reduced. But changes are happening within universities as well. The REF and the metricization of REF that is taking place means that certain users produce benefits in REF terms and other users don't. And just to say, well, effectively, the pursuit of rank order position commits you to produce what high scores for research produce, and that's an internationalization agenda, and the internationalization agenda is rarely a social justice agenda. So what I'll show you now is the research strategy of a university called Russelton. So this is now what Russelton is committed to. What it's committed to is, of course, the same rubbish that everybody's committed to. But what you notice in being committed to the same rubbish that everybody's committed to is we now have a university sector determined to produce rubbish, and it will be the same old rubbish and determined to produce that it's excellent rubbish, to confirm that it's excellent rubbish. So can there be a university that isn't excellent in and isn't committed to research on digital futures, health and well-being, sustainable societies, etc.? Everybody is doing it. But notice, in order to do it properly, we need a governance and management structure, and then we need to start populating these structures, and we need to build impact relationships with impactees. So this is all tightening and coming round. And now this is the metricization. And now we have to have targets. So outcomes become targets. And everything is about increasing the target, and so on. Double the proportion of publications in a 3-year period in the top 10% of most cited outputs. Increase the proportion of international co-authored publications in a 3-year period to over 55%. I'm not saying whether I'm at the University of Russelton, but should you be somebody from an international university outside the UK, avoid me, because I'll be looking to co-author. I'll be sort of chasing after you for sort of co-authorship. But the final really chilling thing is to embed the use of open access citations, H indices, and bibliometrics in the overall approach for the promotion of excellent individuals and for the assessment and the productivity and quality of research teams, where collaborative and co-authored work of the team can be benchmarked. That's the tightest possible version. And the Vice Chancellor of the University of Russelton doesn't like BIS, poking its nose in the autonomy of the university, but is perfectly willing to establish the same practices of centralisation that BIS produced within the university itself. So there really is a vital issue of the autonomy of research and the possibility of doing critical research. And the paradox of it all is this is garbage in, garbage out, in the sense that what it does is produce short-term excellence because nobody's ever going to say anything is not excellent. Short-term excellence that fails to meet the long-term goals that are otherwise identified. And why is there such an emphasis upon the short-term? Because, again, as Wendy Brown suggests, because part of this is opening up the sector to venture capital, and the one thing that venture capital is interested in is short-term outcomes and gains. But the long-term benefits of research, which are demonstrated by authors like Mirofsky, Mazzucato, those are produced under a different kind of knowledge regime, a knowledge regime that is being lost, and lost especially if we don't fight for it. So that's it.
The next person who's going to speak is Nicholas Gane from the University of Warwick.
Thank you. Like John, I'm also interested in the question of neoliberalism, and I'm also interested in the question of the relationship between neoliberalism and the social sciences. Although I'm going to take a slightly different tack here, I'm going to talk about this through the lens of what Foucault can potentially offer us for understanding this relationship. So I want to go back to a text that you all probably know very well, Foucault's Lectures on Biopolitics. This is a text that for me was eye-opening. This is a text that for me got me into thinking about the neoliberal and what the neoliberal might mean. This was a series of lectures that, as you probably know, was delivered at the Collège de France in 1978, 1979. An incredible point in history is the point at which, for people like David Harvey, the neoliberal project was unrolled on the ground under Thatcher and Reagan. So there's a possible coincidence, or did Foucault see something there? Why did he suddenly become interested in questions of neoliberalism around that time? Of course, then the English translation of this text came in 2008, another critical moment in history, just as the financial crisis played out globally. So these lectures then were picked up in various ways. People went back to see what Foucault had to offer, to understand questions of neoliberalism and its relationship with classical liberal forms and so on, and how we might use these to understand the crisis and the way that the crisis played out. This, I think, is a very, very important text. I think it kind of breathed new life into Foucauldian studies, and people started to go back to read between the different lectures and his published texts in very, very important ways. Of course, these lectures are full of problems, and lots of people have pointed out what these problems are. Foucault's understanding of classical liberalism through the text of the lecture course on biopolitics is really difficult. He focuses on Bentham in particular. Why Bentham? Why not Mill? Why does Smith come at the end of this lecture series, and so on? There's not much in there on the importance of Austrian thought. There's not anything at all about the organisation of the neoliberal project as it was rolled out through the Montpellier Society, with all kinds of important global effects and so on. But, and I think this is a big but, that they contain a really important genealogy of neoliberal reason. And I think that this is a very, very subtle history that pays attention to the development of the neoliberal project in different national settings. So the neoliberalism that came out of Austria was different to the German ordo-liberal project, was different to the type of neoliberalism that was rolled out in France, and was different again to the type of neoliberalism, if you can call it that, that came out of the Chicago School in the States. Okay, so I think that there's been a set of critiques that have come out of anthropology recently that have argued that the neoliberal has become a catch-all term. It means anything and everything to do with market-led society. But I think that when you read it through the lens of Foucault, there's a very subtle understanding, historical understanding of what the neoliberal is and its different contextual forms. And for me, Foucault's writings on neoliberalism take the form of genealogy. They chart the emergence of these ideas and where they come from, how they mutate, how they meet each other, and so on. And that for me, this is a project in critical history, just like all of Foucault's other writings that were genealogical in form. Now, not everyone agrees with this interpretation. And I think that there's something interesting to be said about this. So François Évard, a former assistant of Foucault, who some of you may know, was a key figure in the management of his literary estate, has basically come out to argue that Foucault was an apologist for Chicago school neoliberalism, particularly the brand of neoliberalism that was popularized by Gary Becker. And you can go online and you can watch an event where Becker and Évard meet each other in Chicago, and Évard says, you know, Foucault was so interested in your work because he sympathized with it, and so on. Becker's own response was that he'd actually never read any Foucault, but he'd gone away and had a look at the biopolitics lectures, and that actually agreed pretty much with Foucault's account of what Chicago School did, but that he could never tell really whether Foucault sympathized with him or not. Phil Murawski recently, in his quite brilliant book, I think, on the crisis, takes a really critical line of Foucault on Foucault. He takes this position a step further. And he says that Foucault was not a member of what he calls the neoliberal thought collective. That's Murawski's own pet name for the neoliberal cause. But he says he did share quite a bit of common ground with neoliberal doctrines, not least because he portrayed the market as the sole legitimate site for the production of knowledge of the whole. In other words, an absent deity rendered in a manner no different from Hayek, or Stigler, or Friedman, or Buchanan. Buchanan was another president of the Mont Pelerin Society. So Foucault can be grouped together with these sorts of people for Murawski. Now, I want to argue that that's a mistake. So it's not for me, this reading. Both these portrayals, if you look at them, stay quite far removed from Foucault's actual text, in particular the text of his biopolitics lectures. So in relation to Becker, Foucault states the following. He says that the American neoliberals apply, or at any rate try to apply, economic analysis to a series of objects, to domains of behavior or conduct which were not market forms of conduct. But because Foucault gives an historical account of this approach, does not mean he actually supports it in any way. In fact, he says the following. He says, this, of course, raises the question of both theory and method, the problem of the legitimacy of applying such an economic model, the practical problem of the heuristic value of this model, and so on. So the legitimacy of the application of economic analysis to non-economic phenomena is something not to be accepted blindly, but is to be questioned. This, for me, is a key task for the social sciences. I've put sociology here, it's the discipline I come out of, so it's the one I'm most familiar with. But I think that this is a real task for the social sciences, to question the legitimacy of applying economic analysis to non-economic phenomena. So, the other criticism by Murawski of Foucault is that in some ways he treats the market as some kind of deity. Now, if you look at these lecture series closely, Foucault examines the emergence of the market as a site of truth, or what he calls veridiction, from the 18th century onwards. This does not mean that Foucault constructs the market as a deity. Rather, his genealogy is a call to question the positioning of the market within classical liberal and then neoliberal modes, or what he calls arts of governance. And I think Foucault does this in his later work on the self, particularly through his lecture series also, where he writes about what truth is and can be, and about different notions of what the self can be. Okay, so perhaps you get into an argument here that there are notions of truth or the self that need not be captured by the market. In fact, they could be highly resistant to market forms. So what comes from this, I think, is not a blind acceptance of the market and what it should stand for, but rather it's an argument that we should be interested in what markets are and how they operate. Markets should be key sites of sociological interest. One of the most important points Foucault makes is that with the turn to neoliberalism, markets are no longer seen by the neoliberals to be natural. They have to be made in some way. This is the basis of the whole ordo-liberal project that Foucault details in his study of what happened in Germany following World War II. So markets require the help of the state. Hence, there is a move away from classical laissez-faire forms of liberalism. Foucault says that government must accompany the market economy from start to finish. One must govern for the market rather than because of the market. I think we can see this happening in many of the examples that have been given by John and those from the previous session in relation to higher education. Now, the key term here is competition. Foucault says that neoliberalism should not be identified with laissez-faire, but rather with permanent vigilance, activity, and intervention. This is what neoliberalism is really about. And that competition is to play a regulatory role at every moment and in every point in society, thereby promoting the general regulation of society by the market. So there's a notion here that we can have a form of regulation through competition. Is regulation through competition ever going to be regulation enough? This is, of course, a set of arguments that people have revisited time and time again since the recent crisis. So what type of regulation are we talking about here? Well, increasingly, classification and audit are forms of neoliberal governance, and they're there to ensure the marketization of the state and its related institutional forms. So perhaps this is the role that the ref is playing. Perhaps this is the role that all of those league tables are playing. They're injecting principles of competition into areas of the social that previously the market could not reach. So classifications such as HE league tables are fictions, but they're fictions that need to be taken really seriously because they're mechanisms through which neoliberal principles of competition are inserted into social organisations and institutions. Foucault argues that market logics are now everywhere, and I think that that's something that probably needs to be questioned. It made me think of Wendy Brown's earlier point about the fact that marketization or markets are everywhere within the HE sector now. But actually, the reach of the market and the form that reach takes is really important, and I think that this divides many neoliberals and many of the neoliberals from their neo-conservative colleagues. Some of those neoliberals and neoconservatives hold quite traditional values, and they're quite resistant to the encroachment of some market principles into some social forms. There's all kinds of lines of division here that are potentially quite interesting and that could be opened up. So Foucault says something quite interesting. The problem is not whether there are things that you cannot touch and others that you are entitled to touch. So the market can now effectively touch anything. The problem now is the way of doing things. The problem, if you like, of governmental style, the soft touch, the audit, the classification, the seductive mechanisms of competition that induce people to play the game. I would argue that sociology and social science more generally needs to engage critically with this seductive new governmental style that operates through the injection of principles of competition into all spheres of life. So I'm going to finish just by thinking about what social science is and possibly some of the tasks that it might perform in relation to the neoliberal project. So quite frankly, the social is under attack, especially welfarist notions of the social. And this is nothing new. If you were to go back to the early libertarian forms of thought advocated by Mises and his followers, or by Hayek, you'll see this is something that really played out from the 1920s onwards. So Mises argued that all human action could be reduced to an economic principle. For Hayek, the social is nothing more than a weasel word. So there's a challenge here to think critically about the relation between the social and the economic. And I think that this is really something that social science has to take seriously. Has the authority of the former, has the authority of the social largely been displaced by the latter, by economic forms of reason? You know, there's a long line of thinking about this quite critically within social science, within sociology, from people like Barbara Wooten, and more recently by people like Pierre Bourdieu. not to mention Foucault. So, and one of the questions this leaves us with is what form of the social, which is not an unproblematic term in itself, and many people have argued that classical notions of the social are highly exclusive to different populations and interests, what form of the social would we want to defend against this neoliberal attack? I think one of the last attempts to define the social in any political sense was through Anthony Giddens in The Third Way, which obviously we know has to be subjected to critique today. So where do we go after that project? Where does social science take the social after The Third Way? I think that's a really serious point to consider. The other thing that Foucault draws our attention to here is to the historical roots of many forms of contemporary forms of neoliberal discourse. Okay, so I'm not arguing that today we find ourselves in an identical situation to those that the founding figures of social science did. But I think that Foucault draws our attention to the importance of history for thinking about contemporary problems. And I think to treat Foucault as a neoliberal is to lose a vital resource for thinking critically about the present. I think one of the things that we need to do here is to challenge what is often a conception that everything to do with crisis is something new. Everything is we're always in a new situation. There are things that we want to hang on to. There are continuities as well as discontinuities through history. And I think that we could work to reveal many of the critical dependencies of neoliberal thought upon social science, upon the sociological tradition. So John has pointed to a point here that there's an underlying epistemology of neoliberal thought. Where does this come from? Well, I can tell you where it comes from. It primarily comes from an engagement with classical sociology from the 1920s through to the 1950s in the work of people like Hayek and others. So I think there's much work to do here to think about those what the epistemological basis of this project is. And I think that there's much work for social science to do to respond to some of these key figures, such as Hayek and others. Hayek absolutely trashed sociological theory over a course of 20, 30 years, from Weber through to Comte and Saint-Simon, different variants of sociological theory, and you can read this explicitly in his book on the counter-revolutions of science. Where's the sociological response? We're still trying to grapple with some of these ideas. And I think many people, for many years, just threw the neoliberal in a way that could just be dismissed. Oh, that's neoliberal. But I think it's a serious project, and we have to think about the political and epistemological basis of it and engage seriously with these ideas. I think that many of the founding figures have done this. Obviously, people are interested in Karl Polanyi as well as his brother Michael. Durkheim's notion on the basis of Durkheim's critique of Adam Smith at the outset of the division of labour, for example, is still relevant. Weber, Zimmel. But there's a whole line of people through to the 1950s, right the way to people like Raymond Aron that were there at the outset of the Mont Pelerin Society and the Walter Lippmann Colloquium. And fell out with people like Hayek over important things. Much of that history has been lost. Through the 60s, 70s and 80s, there seemed to be no engagement whatsoever with the neoliberal project, and that's interesting. Why was that the case? So finally, just some provocations or thoughts. Sociology is often labelled as the discipline that's best positioned to tackle questions of inequality. Now, Aditya Chakrabarty wrote a provocation in The Guardian on the eve of the BSA conference a few years ago to say that sociology is very good at dealing with downstream questions. You know, you could ask a sociologist to go and tell us about poverty and so on, and inequality. But often what they're not so good at, and I think he's probably right in this critique, is to tell us about the causes, the big structural causes of inequality. Okay, so inequality is often produced and reproduced through markets, through market mechanisms. Okay, so if you were to look at the HE market, you look at the league tables, the same institutions are always at the top. Okay, so why is that the case? It seems that markets reproduce inequalities in important ways. So I think we need to think about the way that markets are made, who they profit, and how exactly do they reproduce certain forms of hierarchy and privilege? How does the relationship between laissez-faire economics and neoliberalism play out today? I think that these were things that were dealt with in real detail by Foucault, and again, they're still important today. So there's a great book out at the moment by Dardo and Laval, two people based in Paris, and their argument about the crisis is actually quite Foucauldian. It's a play on Foucault, and it's very, very interesting. The point they make is that the neoliberals, in the wake of the crisis, said that the crisis resulted from laissez-faire economics. It wasn't the result of the actions of us, the neoliberals. Okay, so they blamed it quite cunningly on laissez-faire economics and say what we need is more government in service of the market, which was precisely the position that they'd already taken. Whereas the left, they argue, fell for the trap. The left said, oh, actually, it's true. The crisis was because of a laissez-faire to economics. What we also need is more government, again, in service of the market. Okay, so many of these historical things, many of the historical points Foucault makes about crisis, about the relationship between laissez-faire liberalism and neoliberalism, are playing out again today in really interesting ways. And finally, I think social science inspired by Foucault can play a key role in questioning how and why neoliberal reason has been able to profit out of the recent crisis, when many predicted the reverse. How has it managed to profit from this situation? Now, if you read Murawski, his argument mainly is based on psychological sources, to say that in times of crisis, people dig in, they retrench, they become more conservative. They don't tend to change their minds. Okay. I think social science has a job here to explain the way that neoliberal reason has profited through crisis through a different set of resources and explanation. And one of the things that's really interesting here, I think, is the organisation of the neoliberal project through its think tanks, through its connection with big business that feeds right the way through these different agencies from intellectual texts right the way through to front bench politics. I did some research in the Hoover Institution last year reading the letters of people like Hayek. And it's incredible how well connected these people were and how many people like Anthony Fisher were working behind the scenes to raise money for the cause. There's a whole organisational structure here, as well as the ideas, that needs to be accounted for, explained, and ultimately criticised. Okay, thanks.
The next speaker, the final speaker this afternoon, is Andrew McGettigan, who's going to talk about human capital in English higher education. Andrew, thank you.
Okay, hopefully you can hear me with this. I'll get that right. I'll just say quickly that I'm going to apologise that it won't match the abstract very closely, largely because the abstract was written before I knew how much time I would have. And so I won't be saying anything about the forms of financial engineering the government is currently investigating, although I'm happy to take questions about that afterwards. I've also probably got a bit too much material, and I'm going to try and edit as I go along here. Basically, this is the overview of what I plan to talk about. To begin very simply with what is human capital, to go back and look at the definitions of it that are offered in these texts from Friedman and Becker and the like, to look at particularly the problem of underinvestment and capital markets, and to move on to that, to particularly the argument for the role of government. My sort of general theory here is that Foucault would have been better to concentrate on Friedman's The Role of Government in Education, and I'm going to offer quite a close reading of Friedman's essay from 1955, and all the quotes from that I take from Friedman are from that text, which in some ways better exemplifies the kind of thing he's looking for in Becker, you know, this entrepreneur of the self, which I think is subtly misplaced in Foucault's reading. I will probably jump over my comments on Foucault and Becker, except for one point which I'll hope to spell out quite the specifics of what the government understands social mobility to be, because I think that's somehow sometimes missed in the discussion of quite what the philosophy behind their interpretation of social mobility is. And then I'll move on to an analysis of the current higher education policy, and particularly, you know, the centrality of the notions developed by Friedman in this policy, and then turn to the question of non-repayment of loans, which is the kind of practical problem the government's wrestling with at the moment, largely because the non-repayment of loans presents a problem for human capital theory, and that should be clear by the time I get to it. I may cut a large part of that section because that's largely interpreting government data to give you the sense of the problem. But I will conclude with some discussion of future policy direction, which in many ways will return to the themes of the earlier session, the session from this morning. Because what I have developed in the Great University Gamble is this notion of a sort of slightly nuanced notion of financialization, which is the process of setting up a unit of accounts and positioning higher education within that system of accounts. And then the graduate is the bearer of the unit of accountability. And so what I'll show you with the next round of policy development that will probably come if... I think it's likely whatever flavour of government we get after 2015 really is this effort to put undergraduate tuition into a system of accounts using basic notions from human capital theory. So hopefully I'll have time to get to that. But that's the overview, and I might jump around a bit, but it gives you a sense of what I'm trying to do. Okay, so what is human capital? It's actually quite basic to begin with. I mean, as Becker says, it organises a very simple idea. And I think this is, in one sense, what to relate to Nick's point. I mean, what that conversation between Ewald and Becker discusses is that Foucault is interested in Becker's way of seeing things. And this manner of thinking is, if you like, is the episteme that he was attracted by, in some sense. Human capital organises a very simple idea. And it is just this notion that individual productivity varies, and what are the factors? So we have natural endowments, skills, ability, natural endowments, culture, environmental factors, skills, knowledge, and health. Anything, so that's the first thing, what it is. Anything that yields an income is by definition a capital. This is Fisher's definition of the difference between income and capital. And it's human capital because it cannot be alienated, unlike physical or financial assets. So this, if you like, is the minimal optic, the minimal definition of the concept, which is largely what is used then to frame the mathematical models you get in Becker and the econometric analysis. And so you can see how it moves quite quickly, kind of from a sort of nominalistic shorthand, these are all the things that are captured under human capital, to then, you know, setting up a whole frame of addressing quite large-scale problems through the methods of economics. And this, in some sense, presents the difficulty of getting a grip on it, because it really is quite a slippery concept. As you'll see when we turn to this next question of what is human capital investment? Here's Becker's definition. Activities that influence future monetary and psychic income, including health, by increasing resources in people. And that can be migration, informing oneself about options, so the kind of research you do about what jobs you might apply for, exercise, going to the doctor, but chiefly education and training. So anything that boosts all those different things that have been captured under the term human capital are understood as investment in human capital. And there's a very classical understanding of investment here. Investment is simply that bit of the resource that you don't consume. So if you think about the scarce allocation of resources here, it's time is the main one that Becker is interested in. And so what's the return? And we get the definition of real returns in Becker, which is psychic plus monetary. So always sort of sitting underneath the text is this rather more complicated notion of what it is you get from human capital investment. But certainly the research by Becker, those of you familiar with human capital, knows that he looks at returns to graduates from 1939, 1949. But also there's the earlier work that Friedman did with Kuznets on professional salaries. So their sort of early findings in under this theory are largely statistical analysis of earnings. And they find that investment in human capital through education training is the best investment you can do at the moment, because you get a 10% return on your investment on average. And schools, universities, anything by extension under this rubric, are firms that specialise in the production of training. And I think this is really the key point, because this is really what universities will come to be seen as in current higher education debate. It's firms that specialise in the production of training. Now, I'm not going to say too much about macro, but obviously there's a whole other lineage of human capital theory within, for example, neo-endogenous growth theory. where it's, you know, one extra variable in a production function. But at the, what we've looked at so far is the micro-investment. Why do individuals choose to make human capital investments? But obviously there's a macro trends that can be related to this, which are changes in inequality. I'll say something about that subsequently. Effect on economic growth. So if you think the classical growth theory, it was the accumulation of physical assets, which was the mark of the sign of growth. That was what was going into their production functions. Human capital adds an extra variable into that, and you also get technological change, etc. And also it looks at changes in unemployment and foreign trade. So if you think about the global race rhetoric that we have a lot at the moment, this is where human capital theory comes in. Just an aside, in the Foucault lectures, it's Robbins' definition that economics is the study of the allocation of scarce resources to competing ends, which is the definition of what neoliberal economic thinking is for Foucault. But also, those of us familiar with the HE context in the UK know that Robbins is the author of the Robbins Report in 1963. This is a, there's an interesting set of questions here that I can't go into in any detail, but obviously we can talk about them. Just to say, this is the point to say that there are rival theories about why people do, for example, degrees. And then these would be discussions of things like credentialism, the need for to do a degree in order to get through certain sifting or screening or selection processes. But these are rival explanations of why people might choose to do a degree. As we've seen when we look at Friedman in particular, you'll see what the kind of key difference is. So this is the essay from 1955. It's collected in Capitalism and Freedom from 1962. And I think this is the key point, the kind of key slippage in how this relies to today. Friedman develops all these concepts that I'm about to go through and quote from are all developed in relation to professional and vocational education. He deliberately separates off general education, education for citizenship, education which has neighbourhood effects, has spillovers for the general social good. That's all separated off, and this treatment is only about professional or vocational education. And I think this is really the sort of key to understanding what's going on in the UK at the moment. So here's Friedman using human capital before Becker does. It's a form of investment, a form of investment in human capital precisely analogous to investment in machinery, buildings, or other forms of non-human capital. Its function is to raise the economic productivity of the human being. If it does so, the individual is rewarded in a free enterprise society by receiving a higher return for his services. So this is just a clear analogy. There's nothing much more sophisticated about it than this, but it enables you to set up the problem and theorise it in certain ways. I mean, the other point to emphasise here is this is a long way from any notions of the public value of education. Becker offers a gloss on this, does so in order to explain why he slips between vocabularies, between registers. Are we talking about financial investment, or are we talking about a productive investment in the individual to be understood as physical? And Becker says, when psychic components dominate, that is when it's psychic income that comes back, psychic return on your investment, then the language associated with consumer durable goods might be considered more appropriate than that associated with investment goods. But to simplify, investment language is used throughout. Okay, so the question is, why would government intervene here? What is the role for government for Friedman? And Friedman addresses two issues. Is the lighting okay? I didn't realise I've chosen a kind of grey background for my slides and might be interfering. It's fine, okay. Okay, so the key issue is to correct market imperfection, the imperfection of the capital markets. Where can you go to get a loan to do your degree if there's no government to fund it? And here's Friedman. Individuals should bear the cost of investment in themselves and receive the rewards, and they should not be prevented by market imperfections from making the investment when they are willing to bear the costs. One way to do this is have the government engage in equity investment, and here there's obviously a register with Wendy's presentation earlier, in human beings of the kind described above. Talk a bit more about this. So the two problems of why the capital markets are reluctant to engage are you can't provide collateral. You know, this is the problem of the investment being inalienable. It's not like a car loan where the bank can come and take back the car, or a mortgage where they can take back the house. And it's difficult to collect. So those of you who follow higher education policy in England will know that with the latest round of attempts to sell the student loans, the student loan company and HMRC will still continue to collect the payments on behalf of the purchaser, potential purchaser, because it's just so difficult to set up any system of collecting human capital investments. It has to be done pretty much through payroll, otherwise you have terrible efficiency problems. And the important thing is that, we'll come on to this in more detail, is that money then follows the investor, so it promotes competitions between institutions. I'll develop a bit more. And we have this other notion of the scarce finance. You know, from the government's perspective, there may be this, the human capital resource of the nation is one thing, but there's also the financial resource that's required to fund even capital investments. But these two problems in relation to market imperfection. And the other one, as I've just mentioned, is this issue of managing the national resource. And those of you who follow things in the Treasury will know that, you know, there's a number of things that have been knocking around the Treasury for the last 20 years, not least notions of national competitiveness, the global race, neo-endogenous growth theory. But the Treasury largely has this sort of small-t human capital theory, that there are five drivers of productivity, and those are skills, competition, enterprise, investment, and innovation. What I'll just say is that when you take those two things together, this is actually probably an anti-consumerist model of education, despite kind of a lot of the discussion about the marketisation of education and the commodification of education. This is an investment model of education, by and large, particularly for degree level. And that's, those kind of tensions play out, I think, at a number of other levels within HE policy in the UK. Okay, I'm going to quickly click through this because some of the detail, I think, is not so relevant. And I've already flagged it up in the introduction. So I think the entrepreneurial self is more appropriate for Friedman and Becker. And this is largely because there's no reference to Coase's work in Foucault's lectures on lectures from 1978-79. And this is important because what I think then he misses is that there are two economic forms, if you like, that are key for neoliberalism. It's markets, but also firms. And it's what is the firm that is kind of the key contribution of Coase to the Chicago School. And then what's interesting is that once you have the grasp of the notion that you've got to factor in the firm here when reading Becker, you'll see that what human capital theory does is it's meant to deepen the theory of specialisation and coordination within the firm, and particularly around the issue of Coase and transaction costs. It also offers a theory of income distribution. So the problem that Becker sets up beginning is why aren't earnings distributed like a normal distribution? We need to have another, there must be some other factor at play. Human capital investment is the thing that we introduce to understand the skew in the distribution of earnings. And importantly, and I think this is the kind of key concept for social mobility, Becker's family is an intergenerational firm making investment decisions. I mean, so the issue is it's familia oeconomica, not homo economicus, and families invest in the human capital of their children. Those of you who read David Willetts' contribution to this, which I think is absolutely crucial for understanding some of it, is that Willetts wants to introduce a third element. So you have individuals, you have families, and you have generations. And it's key, he sits within this debate. But the other thing here is obviously Thatcher's remark, and I think we've already had this in relation, was it Hayek earlier from Nicholas, that there's no such thing as society. There are individuals and there are families, is the full Margaret Thatcher code. So the family is the basic social unit here, making investment decisions. Now, here's how this plays out in terms of discussions of equality. And in Foucault's discussion, there's a lot of focus on innate elements of human capital and genetics, but Becker and Friedman are both clear. It's human capital investment dominates ability in the sense that econometricians use dominates. And without functional capital markets, wealth would dominate both. It would dominate ability and the ability to pursue human capital investment, and that's unfair advantage. So if you think about families as competing firms, competing dynastically and intergenerationally, you have some idea of what kind of notion of competition is relevant here. So the aim of social policy is to create conditions for families to compete in the game of social mobility. Long-run inequality is not then determined by class if access to capital is not constrained. Smart human capital investment can overturn the results of bad decisions made by grandparents. So the government providing capital avoids underinvestment from poorer families who might otherwise have to choose between which children to invest in, also whether to invest at all. So this, I think, is quite a fundamental way to understand what's going on when you read articles on social mobility by econometricians, is this is the notion of social mobility. How did positions within families change across the generations? So you can do without any notion of class or poverty or inequality, as John said, as long as the game's fair in a certain sense. Okay, so this is, to sort of hammer home this point, this is Friedman from Role of Government and Education. Existing imperfections in the capital market tend to restrict the more expensive vocational professional training to individuals whose parents or benefactors can finance the training required. They make such individuals a non-competing group sheltered from competition by the unavailability of the necessary capital to to many individuals, among whom must be large numbers of equal ability. The results perpetuate inequalities in wealth and status. The development of arrangements such as those outlined above would make capital more widely available and would thereby do much to make equality of opportunity a reality, to diminish inequalities of wealth and income, and to promote the full use of our human resources, the nation's human resources. And it would do so not like the outright redistribution of income by impeding competition, destroying incentive, and dealing with symptoms, but by strengthening competition, making incentive effective, and eliminating the causes of inequality. 2 minutes, ouch. Okay. What I would just say here is that the... I'll skip over that. Okay. So, what you also get developed in the Freeman is the theory in Nietzsche of income contingent repayment loans. This is what equity investment by government should look like. The government buys a share in an individual's earning prospects, advances him, sick, the funds needed to finance his training on condition that he agreed to pay the lender a specified fraction of his future earnings. In this way, a lender would get back more than his initial investment from relatively successful individuals, which would compensate for the failure to recoup his original investment from the unsuccessful. The borrower would obligate himself to pay the state a specified fraction of his earnings above some minimum, the fraction of the minimum being determined to make the program self-financing. Here's kind of the key problem for the UK is that the program is not self-financing at the moment, because what the UK government's added in is obviously the policy write-off. But this gives you basically the outline of income contingent repayment loans in 1955. I've got 2 minutes, so I'm going to make some points. I think the weakest point here is probably the aspect of what competition between educational institutions look like. Those familiar with my work with The Guardian will know we've been paying a lot of attention to what competition innovation looks like at the sharp end of private higher education provision. But the point I would sort of pull out here is that Friedman is keen that the loans go to individuals and not to institutions, and that really the problem with subsidising institutions rather than people has led to an indiscriminate subsidisation of whatever activities it is appropriate for such institutions to undertake, rather than of activities it is appropriate for the state to subsidise. The problem is not primarily we were spending too little money, but we're getting so little per dollar spent. This is the problem of misinvestment or overinvestment that the government is concerned about. And people are over-educating themselves from the perspective of human capital theory. If graduates are doing non-graduate jobs, that's not a problem if you have a theory of credentialism, that what degree does is show what kind of person you are and that you can do the job better than someone who doesn't have a degree. But it is a problem for human capital theory, because human capital theory requires an idea that the education increases productivity, not simply gets a foot in the door. So I'll kind of I'll probably conclude at this point and maybe go on to skip through to one more slide. This is how higher education is now envisaged in the 2011 White Paper. It's a human capital investment that benefits the private individual, so it enables that individual to boost future earnings. Universities are then judged by how well they provide training that increases graduate earning profiles. And this is where I'd like your indulgence, just to skip through to past this problem of non-repayment to this question of future policy direction. And this is what I'll conclude with. Obviously, the government can change the terms of repayment. That's one option they have. To remove the subsidy that's currently in the scheme. Gamund has mentioned the introduction of the minimum tariff for access to student loan support. I think that's almost necessary from the perspective of the Treasury at the moment. And really what this introduces is the notion of creditworthiness. Is the borrower a creditworthy borrower? Is this someone who can benefit from higher education in Robbins's sense, but viewed through the optic of repaying what's been lent? So this is a judgment by the Treasury as to who can benefit from HM, not the individual university. They can sell or securitise. Human capital may not be alienable, but it's certainly securitisable. And this is where the financial engineering dovetails with these questions of human capital. Or you can involve universities in a debt-credit relation. At present, the debt is between the individuals and the state. The university gets the fees. The individual borrows the money to pay the fees to the university. The university provides the training. But then for the next 35 years, the debt relation is between the individual and the university. This is what I think is the government's kind of key policy problem at the moment. And this is what is currently being investigated as a live policy option. Can you get universities to buy the risk on their own graduates' repayment? And how can you incentivize universities to do this? Because this is the key issue, is that Those of you from England are familiar now with this, and those of you who saw Kaminda's presentation earlier are familiar with this 45% loss figure. This is an average. This is the average loss from the scheme. This is how, you know, this is when you send a pound out into the world, you get 50, the equivalent of 55p back, and you lose 45p. Now, this is the sort of policy aspiration at the moment, and this wouldn't be a fiction in a certain sense, because it's all about money coming back, and you know, this is what the government is really keen on. This is the measure to rule all measures. And here's David Willetts speaking in 2012. I expect in the future, as the data accrue, the policy debate about the RAB charge, this is the accounting terminology for the loss on loans. The loss on loans for individual institutions, the actual exchequer risk from lending to students at specific universities. Imagine in the future we discover that the RAB charge for a Bristol graduate was 10%, i.e. they pay back the equivalent of 90p in the pounds that they borrowed. Maybe some other university we're only going to get 60% back. Going beyond that, it becomes an interesting question to what extent you can incentivise universities to lower their own RAB charges. And this is where the credit default swap might work, a certain kind of spread betting that you say to the university, this is the par, and if you get the repayment better than par, then you will get a taste of that additional revenue coming back to the Treasury. Some of you may be familiar with the research being done by Neil Shepherd and Anna Vignoles. They have got access to the Student Loans Company database and HMR revenue and customs data, and they are looking at labour market outcomes of similar courses at different institutions. Here's their description on the Nuffield Foundation website. If different degrees from different institutions result in very different levels of earnings for students with similar pre-university qualifications and from similar socioeconomic backgrounds, that's the speak for social mobility as I outlined earlier, then this might affect both student choice and policies designed to increase participation and improve social mobility. It's at this point that choice gets circumscribed, restricted, or nudged, if you prefer. But this is really the issue. So certain choices are just bad choices from a human capital investment perspective, then they should be ended. Here is the latest thing with which I will finish. This is FEAR, F.E.R. This was in last week's publication by Lord Young, who is David Cameron's enterprise czar. This publication is called Enterprise for All. FEAR is the future earnings and employment record. The proposal is to publish and index future employment earnings data in a simple and accessible format so that students can access the full costs and likely benefits of specific courses at specific institutions, and that would be all data for 10 years post-completion. Again, promotes competition in the manner that we're already familiar with. Final slide. Thank you. What's kind of telling about that document, and those of you who follow schools debates will realise it has this whiff of Michael Gove about it. It has this you know, this mix of cynicism, irony, contempt, and this desperate effort to épater les profs, you know, to give affront to professors. This article has subheadings with things like what fear will do, you know, and then a discussion of how this will incentivise universities. And, you know, it's no accident. I don't want to belabour this. But this is coming from several different directions now within government. And it's all to do with this idea of the creditworthiness of individuals and institutions. How much should this applicant from this district, of this city, with these qualifications, the individual, be lent to this course at this institution? These two aspects of creditworthiness. What are they likely to repay? And a good university is one that produces graduates able to repay more. Now, again, to finish with the point that Mike makes, these are exploratory efforts in accounting. You know, there's an attempt to create an accounting system. But really, the first policy goal is a very, very simple one. They need a justification for allowing STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, and medicine subjects at elite universities to charge more than 9,000. They can't just say the Rosser Group is allowed to charge more than 9,000 tuition fees. But if they have a kind of rough metric that points out to which graduates from which institutions are good for it, then they will lift the cap, but partially. And I think to conclude, what I think this is really pointing to is the kind of the dissolution of the 1993 settlement. I don't think we will have a unitary funding scheme for undergraduate tuition in the UK after this, because what this is really designed to do is this thing that you get in Friedman, that the repayment demanded should in principle vary from individual to individual in accordance with any differences in expected earning capacity, and that can be predicted in advance. The problem is similar to that of varying life insurance premium among groups that have different life expectancy. And this is pricing. This is exactly the same pricing that you would need to have with this data if you wanted to build investment grade product, debt products off the back of graduates. Okay, I'll finish there.
Okay, we have some time for questions now, and the speakers are just going to come back and join us here. I think, again, there are microphones. Can I yet again ask you, please, to just give your name and your institution before you ask a question? Thank you.
I'm sorry about that.
Okay, so are there questions, comments, and perhaps we might, to start with, just take a couple of questions and then ask the speakers. So, to respond.
Just a question for Andrew McGettigan. David Willetts produced a pamphlet at the 50th anniversary of Robbins last year. I gather from what you said that we shouldn't make Robbins turn in his grave, and I just wondered if you'd expand a little bit more on Robbins' role in the road to the market.
Thanks, have a question.
Okay, thank you. There's a second person, I think. Was there somebody at the back? There's somebody there, okay. We just take this one, and then if you'd like to respond.
I think I touched upon...
Hang on, we're taking the next question.
Oh, sorry, I thought you were saying while we wait.
No.
Okay.
Hello, Maya Powell from Sussex. I have a question to John about your distinction between research with and research about, and this issue about interdisciplinarity, which I thought was very interesting. And I think there's a particular problem in international relations, anthropology, and the role of military organisations in universities, and really trying to get a grip being part of the teaching profession in certain universities. And so, yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, and I'd like to know more about, you know, how do we do that? Because a lot of academics will say, well, if we do research with, then we can do research about. And, so it's this trap. And is this a way in which we can maybe think of resisting, you know, this is the topic of the conference, and trying to stop, you know, this illusion that we can do research about by doing research with?
Do you want to reply first to that one, since it was specifically you, and then we'll come back to the other one? Is that okay?
Yep, okay. Yes, I think it is a conundrum. I'm not, wasn't making the distinction or developing the distinction in order to rule out interesting possible combinations. I think it is necessary to get access to the research field, and frequently in terms of getting access to a research field and particularly involving elite actors, then looking as if you are doing research with does enable you to do research about. I think one of the problems is, though, that you also have constraints in relation to research ethics. And I think one of the issues of, you know, research ethics hasn't caught up with the impact agenda, because as soon as you're dealing with the co-production of research with a beneficiary, the beneficiary isn't necessarily the person. You are frequently doing research about somebody else, where a beneficiary, in a sense, acts as a gatekeeper to people and so on. And I think in quite a lot of cases, people are doing research with research subjects who are not part of that negotiation and not part of the reflection in research ethics. That applies where you're, if you like, doing research with participants who are, you know, less advantaged, if you like. There's an equivalent problem when you're doing research with people who are advantaged, because if you haven't tackled that research ethics issue, you do face the question. If you look at certainly the ESRC's research ethics guidelines, there is a question where vulnerable actors includes powerful actors whose reputation might be made vulnerable in the course of your kind of research. So, that was in the last change of the ESRC guidelines, that curiously vulnerability brought in reputation and in a sense actually brought powerful actors into a new category of possible victims of social research. So I think that the general academic response to research ethics issues is to think the whole thing has got too kind of overwhelming and too bureaucratic, but there are, you know, areas where we really need to address that issue, and we ought to be developing, I think, a sort of ethics within social science that facilitates doing research about powerful people for the cause of social justice and so on. And so I'm not suggesting you shouldn't do research with powerful actors, but that you potentially need to think how to manage the situation of turning that to the advantage of different kinds of publics and beneficiaries. And the tendency is to specify beneficiaries quite tightly.
Thank you. Nick, perhaps if we could return to the previous question now, would you like to respond?
Yeah, I think it was me. Okay. I mean, David Willetts' argument in that pamphlet, if I'm recalling it correctly, is that Robbins considered loans but didn't think it was politically possible. So that, you know, David Willetts likes to present the current coalition as if he said it's the true heirs because they finally managed to bring in what something that Robbins considered and thought appropriate. But, I mean, just to make two brief points. I mean, when Robbins talks about, you know, it should be available to anyone who can benefit, the definition of who can benefit is you have two A levels. So there's a tariff there, and there's a, you know, in a certain sense, if you want to push it through a human capital optic, this is, you know, the individuals who can benefit are determined there by preceding qualifications and not necessarily a judgment for autonomous institutions to make. The other echo, if you like, is that Robbins envisaged that the expansion would take place in science, technology, and engineering. But as we know, what happened was the people who had those two A levels turned out to want to do arts and social sciences. And so, this is the constant tenor of reform again, is how can we make people do choices which are better investments? And here, I think, you know, a large part of policy is either nudging people towards vocational professional courses, or in fact, in the end, I think what we'll see is more and more restrictions on which courses are available. If only by free, you know, if only through the sort of fiscal drag effect of holding the 9,000 fee cap in place through another parliament for courses where graduates aren't demonstrating significant repayment proportions on the loans. And you can already see some of this in the National Audit Office report from November. They have a technical annex which is already breaking down repayment profiles by mission group and by subject, showing, you know, what percentage medical students pay back, what percentage Russell Group students pay back. And you're already getting the sense of the National Audit Office pushing this idea that really there needs to be some kind of credit control here, some kind of credit rationing, you know, to determine which individuals should be allowed to do which courses, because academic selection isn't enough.
Thank you.
Wendy Brown, Berkeley. Andrew, I that was just so rich. I wanted to hear the whole hour and a half that you didn't have time for. But two little questions. I think all of us have this tendency when we're talking about neoliberalism and neoliberal reason, and Foucault had it too, to make it all sound actually quite coherent and non-contradictory. And there's two little places in your presentation that I wanted to open up a little bit. One is that moment in Becker where he opens up the idea of familia economica in addition to homo economicus. And of course, part of what he's doing there is trying to do something Thatcher and others were also trying to do by saying the basic social unit is the family and not just the individual, which was to naturalize the family and to introduce a social conservatism and familialism into something that is undoing it at every turn, namely the notion of human capital. And you put the emphasis on the investments in children. Becker has to back up and deal with what he calls the psychic investment of women giving up income streams in order to have investments in children and so forth. And I wonder if you have a bit more to say about that incoherent moment between family and individual, and particularly its attempt to finesse a gender and familial inequality that human capital actually oddly levels if left alone, if left to the individual unit of analysis rather than introducing the family. The other has to do with the credit default swap moment and the potential pricing of majors and schools. I mean, one thing that's happened in the United States is that pricing has already happened, say, in law schools, engineering schools, medical schools, and so forth. But it often flops, and the places where it's flopped most recently has to do with law schools, which priced themselves way outside of a market that they ended up not having for graduates of law schools. And part of the reason they're not having it is that it's become cheaper for law firms to hire paralegals en masse than lawyers who have expensive loans to repay and also command a high price. And, of course, that's likely to happen in more and more fields because that's exactly the way that financialization works. So I'm raising both of these to introduce a bit of incoherence into the otherwise seamless picture because that incoherence, of course, is also always a place for potential critique and, more importantly, activism. But I wonder also if you could just talk about whether you think that pricing structure for majors, for schools, for disciplines actually holds once, for example, anthropology is very cheap to major in and, say, business is more expensive, but business can then be can then replace business graduates with anthropologists who need jobs and don't have them in anthropology but can function as para-business people in the business world.
Should we take the next question as well? Because there's only 2 minutes left.
Okay.
Could we take that next question, please, as well? And then very, very quickly.
Hi, I'm Beth Popperman, SUNY Albany. And I have a question also that's sort of about the general human capital theme. You know, I appreciate that there's a lot of attention to what the origins of the idea of human capital are and how it links up. But I wanted to sort of ask two questions about that follow on to that. One is, I wonder if anybody can speak a little bit to the question of why now? You know, we're talking about some ideas that I think are important to explore, but that also, you know, were laid out 50 years ago. And I think you can say, well, there's been a lot of institution building to try to bring these changes about. But at the same time, you know, Reagan and Thatcher are still 30 years ago now. And so what's different about this particular moment in time, and how does that link to a larger story about human capital? And the second part of that is, I wonder if people could speak a little bit to the question of how it can go, how human capital arguments can go other ways as well. And I'm thinking particularly here, the case that I know something about is the war on poverty in the U.S. And the war on poverty was largely couched in human capital arguments, in human capital terms. There was a lot of language about let's invest in poor people, let's provide them health care so that they're able to improve their job market outcomes, let's improve their educational capacity so that they can have better lives. And they weren't necessarily buying into the whole Friedman, the idea that you need to create, you know, the right kinds of markets for investment in human capital, but they were very much drawing on the same kinds of arguments. And so I'm wondering if there are possibilities in the present for using human capital arguments in more in other sorts of political ways, or more generally, why one set of forms of human capital arguments seem to have become so important and other ones have fallen by the wayside.
Shall I?
Perhaps you have to be very
okay,
brief.
Okay, very brief. I'll talk about this question first. That's a vast problem, and I think the incoherence is fundamental. I don't know if you know Walter McMahon's compendium recently of, you know, trying to assess the human capital, the return on higher education investment. His chapters on, some of the chapters on the returns to investment in women are to do with how efficiently they manage the household, and the research he's referencing is from early 1970s, but this is in a book in 2009, which is supposedly the sort of up-to-date answer on what are all the returns to investment in education. So this is hugely problematic.
I think some attempt to naturalise it is also to, I think there's an explicit agenda to get away from any notion of class, and the family is a convenient, natural point on which to hang this analysis. But also, in particular in Becker, there's a whole other thing that we haven't really talked about here, which Foucault touches upon, which is Becker's theory of the production of satisfaction within the household, and the paternalistic division of labour, even within that concept. So when Friedman says, I think the quote I had up there is the basic social unit is the family, and individual freedom is the principle, is the next bit, which I didn't have. But it's so clear that it's the male head of the family is making the investment decisions here. What's interesting from this perspective is David Willetts, our minister for universities, wrote a book 2 years ago called The Pinch, which, if you like, goes back into similar terrain, with particularly his concerns about the breakup of the household in the 1980s, women entering the labour market, and the disruption this causes to the traditional approach of the welfare state. I mean, that's a fascinating document in itself, in an effort to sort of wrestle with this. With this conundrum, I can't really sort of say a bit more at this point, given time. The law school here is very different, because the intention of our reforms was to free up private providers to come in and undercut established law, business, and accounting provision. So we already had a very mature, complicated private sector market in the UK around law. But when these reforms came in and direct institutional grants were removed to universities, to their perspective, that removed the industrial subsidy and allowed the private providers to come in and charge 6,000. So a lot of them are operating in a very different way, and they are specialising in 2-year accelerated paralegal studies degrees in order to address that problem that you talk about, but who should firms hire? In some ways, our whole the whole approach you can see in our government has come at this from a different perspective. But this is the problem that's always there within the kind of the Coase and the Becker analysis is. Businesses are very happy if the costs are externalised. It doesn't matter how expensive the university gets if those costs don't come back. And it's when you start analysing the transaction costs from the Coasean perspective, this is where these kind of effects happen. So the other thing would be businesses in the UK complaining that 70% of graduates have 2-1s. How can they do their SIFT or their selection when they got to go through all these applicants? They want something to come out of universities, which means they don't have to then construct a whole expensive selection process on the back, which is another kind of spillover from this model. So these things are kind of pushing back in two ways. In the UK, we don't see so much this problem of indebted graduates going for, creating problems for recruiters. We sort of see the other angle, which is cheaper accelerated degrees being offered to students who can get into a job much more quickly, maybe within 2 years, with much lower debts. And in some cases, you will see the companies sponsor the better students to do that through closed courses or similar.
I'm really sorry, but okay. I'm afraid we're going to have to stop here because we've run out of time and we're in danger of running into other people's time as well. So could I just ask you to thank the speakers once again.